This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your... Let's see here. Wednesday. Hey, I'm serious. I'm trying to get, it's the snow being in late March like this, and it still has not got warm. I think that's what's messing up with my mind.
I'm not going to be happy about this Friday, Saturday forecast I'm seeing.
Well, I got some good news for you. I got some really good news for you. Twins baseball starts tomorrow, although not in town, because it would be a brutal game tomorrow. That would be brutal. Nope. It is a Twins start tomorrow. I'll tell you what. I got a sports thing I got to get to here. We'll talk some Twin stuff tomorrow as well. But how are you today? How are things here at the Palatial Broadcasting Complex?
I'm going well here.
All right. I have had an interesting day because I tweeted something. All right. Have you noticed this is Republicans in Minnesota right now? This is Republicans in Minnesota. How dare the DFL, who were just elected into total power in the state, pass the bills they said they would pass while they were campaigning without every Republican voting along in unison? This is classic overreach. Tell me I'm lying. Am I lying? I'm not lying. That's exactly how all the Republicans are acting, right? It has led to some interesting interactions today. I've hit close to home. These guys are livid with me. All 500 of the guys I've blocked today that have like 30 followers. Yeah, you know, sure. Yeah, you got a lot to say there. I don't know why you think I have to interact with you. You really look obnoxious. I'm not going to interact with you because, you know, not really that worthwhile of me to interact with. That being said, I should mention, by the way, I should just really quick get some business out of the way. I've got three people on the top of the Matt McNeil Show, Mount Rushmore. Two of them are going to be here today. Of course, Schechter is the other one, but he's not going to be here today. But Jeff Stein coming up here at 3:30. Jack Rice coming up here at 4:30 to talk about the Lazaro case. I should tell you the response when I said when he went and read up on Lazaro. He's like, you got to be kidding me. You said it. I'll give Brett the credit. You said it last week. Why did he go to trial, man? This is not a... they got delayed today, by the way. They didn't start until like 12:45. So we'll hopefully have an update here before we get to Jack a little bit later on. So I post this once again. The tweet is, Republicans in Minnesota, how dare the Minnesota DFL, who were just elected into total power in the state, pass the bills they said they would pass while campaigning without every Republican voting along in unison. Classic overreach. That's Republicans today. Because they got their boo-boo kitty feelings hurt. They got their boo-boo kitty feelings hurt. They ran a loon ball for governor. they ran an insane, you know, absolutely an insane candidate for Secretary of State. I don't know if you saw we talked about it when they showed the new districts when we drew the districts here with the last census. And we had like three freaking shows where we went through this. It's like, all right, I'm doing the math here. How do the Republicans win statewide again? And I said the closest is going to be the Senate, but you know, even in a bad year, it's only going to be maybe a one or two seat win for the Republicans in the Senate. And I don't know if they can ever win back the House, if you want to know the truth. But, you know, there was a cavalcade of absolute debauchery that occurred on the Republican side, along with stuff like Minneapolis is a war zone. I mean, gosh, how many new buildings are they building in that war zone? It is delightful for a war zone. I'll tell you what, the shopping is getting a lot better. It's a ghost town, but those ghost towns, they got good Danish. Have I mentioned those ghost Danish? Oh, they fill you right up. Oh, lots of butter. Delicious. So here you are. You've lost. You had all this budget. And by the way, can I just, the cherry that rides on the top of my daily sundae every day since November. You had the chance to pass a bipartisan bill last year, and you guys said, no, we're going to get complete control of the state government, and we're going to jam our agenda down your throat. That's what you did. That's what you said. There was nothing more hilarious than the day after the election. Some Republicans in the states are, you remember when you said that you'd be willing to do that bipartisan bill that you said we turned down? You know, we're going to hold you to that now. Hey, they said no thanks. They said, we're not gonna really worry about that, all right? So, it's a hoot. So here we are, and this is all the Republicans have, because the Democrats are getting stuff done, and they're getting a lot of stuff done, too, and a lot of good things done, too. And so all they can do is they can basically scream, it's classic overreach, and hope, and beg, and pray that somehow, some way that resonates, and basically people aren't happy with the utopia that Minnesota is becoming. Heaven forbid. Now, that being said, it has not stopped the trolls. And all these guys, like 40, 50. I had one guy who's been on Twitter since 2020, and he had 22 followers. So 3 years, 22 followers. You know, that's, you know, maybe you're the jackass. Can I just say that? Maybe no one really cares what you have to think. It never crossed your mind. It never did. That basically you still could not get, a youth soccer team worth of followers. Okay. Your standard second grade class to follow you. So, all right, I guess 23 was a bridge too far for you. Okay, well, good luck with all that. But my favorite part of this is how these trolls, these howler monkeys, these people that are basically probably not even here in Minnesota, let's just be honest, who basically create these comments, they're basically screaming, have created mythical things that have happened to try to blame the Democrats for not addressing them or going too far. I think the most common one I've seen today is, and by the way, my block button works great, because if I can look at three words from you and determine, wow, you really have nothing to say, I can block you. That really is a bad reflection on you. And a reminder, you're coming to my page, so you're the one looking for validation. I don't give it to you. I've been smacking people back left and right. It's been hilarious. I've had a great time today with some of these shots. There's been, if you go look at my replies up on Twitter, there's a few that are just a smidge too harsh. But you know, yeah, it's you come at the king, you better hit your mark, man. That's all I'm going to say. Now, the fake things. One is when it comes to transgender bills, that this is quite literally the way that the Republicans have described this to me is like a six-year-old can walk into a doctor's office and, well, it's two different things. Walk into a doctor's office without a parent and say, mutilate my genitals. And the doctor is like, right away, ma'am. And that does not happen. I don't know where you came up with this. But that's not real. The other one is, what happens when someone takes a child from their parents into another state? Well, that's called kidnapping. We do have laws on the books nationwide, pretty much. Does anyone not have a kidnapping clause? Probably Texas or something like that, or Oklahoma. They were just having a disagreement. They might guess, but... Does anyone not have a kidnapping is illegal clause in their state contract? Because your entire argument is negated by the fact that you have to overlook the crime that you insist will not get prosecuted. Kidnapping of a young child to basically then get to your point of, and here's where the real crime begins. Well, no, they'll be arrested for kidnapping. And are they going to walk into a doctor's office? You think the doctor's like, well, here's this child that clearly doesn't want to be with his adult. Well, I better perform a surgery on them. No, of course not. So you're just making stuff up. But my favorite of the makeups is has to do with women's choice. Because we talked about the abortion issue and that Republicans, almost all of them, screamed the same thing, which was that apparently their impression was there are millions of abortions that happen in Minnesota the day before the woman is about to give birth. Now, that hasn't happened. I mean, I'm not sure if there have been cases where the life of the mother is going, the mom's going to die if they haven't. And God be with all of you if you have to go through something like this. I've had friends lose babies at the very end, and it is incredibly hard. No one is just going through 9 months of pregnancy and saying one day, well, I'm done with this. No. That is a made-up thing. But it doesn't stop Republicans. Because, and once again, this is not me saying this. This is not me just saying that hasn't happened. They actually listed the amount of times there has been an abortion in the third term. It was one at like the first week of the third term, and it had to do with to save the woman's life, the mom's life. Now, Republicans might come on out there and say, well, if God wants mom to die, it sucks to be her. You know, but, you know, I'd say save the woman's life because, you know, God, you know, it's just the way, you know, things are. I mean, it's not a pleasant situation. It's not a thing that you want to, you know, be happy with in any capacity. But if I, you know, you have to save the woman's life, save the mom's life, for goodness sakes. But that was, like I said, like the first week of the third trimester. They haven't had one of these mythical abortions that the Republicans keep screaming happen at the very last moment, right before they give birth. And this is because this is how they, once again, this is how Republicans try to turn themselves into sanctimonious by basically saying they're giving birth and they're murdering the baby, you know, like that sort of thing. That's how they do it. And they're just making this up. You're making up something and then criticizing. You're making up a thing. You are making up something and then criticizing the Democrats for not addressing the made-up crime that you have had. And your argument is, well, it could happen. Now, two can play at that game, can't we? I think we can. Let's just say there's a Republican representative that every time he goes to the grocery store, he runs around the deli counter, drops trow, and then violates the bologna ring. You know, just, oh my, what are you, well, if they wouldn't have put the clown face on there, you know. Okay. You know, why haven't the Republicans introduced the Stop That Representative from Violating the Lunch Meat Act of 2023, for goodness sakes? Why are you against the lunch meat? You see, I can do it too. I made up a completely farcical thing that does not happen. But I can make it up. Republican representative violates the bologna ring. Violates the bologna ring. Why haven't the Republicans introduced a bill to stop that mythical Republican representative from running around the deli counter, dropping trow, grabbing the lunch meat, and going to town? Huh? Come on. Explain it to me, huh? The Republicans must be for the violation of lunch meat in that case, correct? Aha! I think we've figured out the whole thing here, haven't we? Or I'm just making up a mythical thing and then basically using that mythical thing to attack the other side of the aisle. You see, it's one of the two. So, let me just say for the record, you're loon balls. Seriously, you're broken people. I can't help you. I'm sorry you don't have the validation in your life you're looking for, but you clearly don't need it from me. I mean, I am not going to tolerate you basically walking into my house and going, bah! So I block you. And it sucks to be you. You know, I do. I really feel sorry for you. But the reality is, the reason why you guys are so upset is because you know what I said originally is 100% true. The Democrats won the election. The Democrats are now in charge. The Democrats told everyone this is what they're going to do, and the Democrats are doing it. And all you can do, the same political party that whenever they were in charge of the Senate would proudly say to the Democrats, sit down and shut up. All you can do is throw a pity party for yourself because you're a little snowflake. And that's the reality. You're a little snowflake that has to turn yourself into the victim of this world. And I can't help you. I can't help you. I don't, I'm sorry the truth hurts, guys, but maybe, just maybe, you should look at the quality of your candidates and what you're doing and saying, pulling people's rights away, trying to create a second-tier class of human being, that's not exactly resonating with the voters. Just saying. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. So one of the things that's interesting, Axios has an interesting article here that apparently Jacob Fry is open to the idea of transitioning some of these office buildings down, the high skyscraper office buildings, into residential. And I am not against this idea. As a matter of fact, I think it's a good idea. As a matter of fact, can I be blunt? It might be a really good way to help address some of the low-income housing problems we have in this state, in the city right now. I mean, I was looking at this, and bravo to, it's the building they're going to build across on Central, right on the St. Anthony side of the downtown. They're going to build an apartment complex, and it sounds like a good chunk of the apartments in there are going to be lower income housing. Fantastic. Wonderful. That's a huge problem right now. But I have said, I mean, you know, there is a logical thing. I mean, people that come to me and they say, and speaking of delusional idiots that come in, you know, after me, they say, Minneapolis is the least safe it's ever been. It's like, dude, have you ever read a history book? Because no, this downtown, as you see it right now, is probably the safest it's ever been. Ever been. We can go back to the transient lumberjack issues they used to have back in the 1860s and 70s, the flop houses and the dive bars, Doc Ames when he controlled the downtown, the mobsters running anything, the labor wars that were going on downtown, the destruction of a good chunk of the downtown as it became abandoned, the empty parking lot after parking lot after parking lot that basically ran the entire length of Washington Avenue and a good chunk of First. The fact that when people thought when they renovated Butler Square, they were insane. What, no one wants to go over there. That's the old warehouse district. It's like Shag and Scoob disappeared in there a few years ago. Why would you want to go in there? That sort of thing. Do you remember 20 years ago, they couldn't get a grocery store downtown. Now they can't build them fast enough. You got so many people living downtown right now. And you got a bit of a housing issue. So, you can see my inner machinations working. Although, I do get this. I mean, if you did have the top floor, like, is something, and I'm not saying the IDS is, they're suggesting they're renovating the IDS. But if someone did renovate the IDS into apartments, what do you think the top floor of that place would be?
Oh, yeah, that's the what I was kind of thinking, too, with some of these. I like the idea. I just hope they don't turn them all into, like, luxury apartments.
Oh, God. Well, but the top ones, you got to make luxury.
Yeah, exactly.
You're going to
make
luxury. You know, that top, if you had, like, and if it's like other major metro areas, it'd probably be the top two floors. It'd probably be a 4,000-square-foot huge place with multiple bedrooms, bathrooms, patios, and stuff like that. Easy $15 million. With views of every direction.
Oh, yeah.
Easy 15, wouldn't you? If it was two floors on the top of the IDS, it'd have to be.
I don't think, you and I are going to be buying that.
Patrick?
Patrick
is going to put a bid on that. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Fry beginning to push to convert office towers into apartments. Downtown continues to struggle because of a loss of office workers, and Fry told Axios, you almost think I might, doing that intentionally. Fry told the Axios replacing some of them with residents will liven up the core of the city. The shift to remote and hybrid work is leading to rising vacancy rates for downtown and suburban buildings in the metro. Companies are downsizing their offices, sometimes shredding as much as 75% of their office space. Now, I think we are kind of, at least the way I get it, it does seem like we're kind of getting into the new normal now, that we're settling in, that there are some businesses that, nope, we need you in. Some business, even, I mean, I'm not saying there are some stricter businesses that want people in 5 days a week, and some businesses that, you know, require you have to go in 5 days a week, and that's, you know, maybe more blue collar mechanical stuff like that. But for the white collar people, I think that there are some businesses, some jobs that still need you to come in every day. But even the more stringent guys who were real hesitant back in 2020 to allow people to work from home during the COVID thing, a lot of them have kind of changed their way because they're losing out on decent employees to companies who are basically saying, yeah, you can remote work 4 days out of five. And so they're having to ease up on this a little bit. Turning office space into apartments could help solve the metro's housing shortage, but it's not that easy. Real estate experts told Axios the cost of converting the towers can be prohibitive without government help. Of course it is. Fry is ready to offer city assistance. Of course he is. What exactly could that look like? It's still taking shape. One tool he mentioned is a tax increment financing, TIF, which uses the additional property tax revenue from the project to pay for the development costs. I got to believe that that would indeed dramatically increase the tax potential for any of those buildings. Moving them from an office space to a residential, I got to believe that'd be the case. The city approved $12.3 million TIF package for a $75 million conversion of downtown's North Star Center East office building into 216 apartments, 20% of which would be income restricted. Fry said the city is ready to be a TIF partner on more projects. He noted there is no blank checks here. Well, yeah, kind of. hey, who wants a TIF check? Well, but, you know, there's no blank ones. We'll fill in those numbers. But still, I mean, it's, we're not going to give you a blank check. We'll just, how much should we put into the numbers, I guess is the case. It sounds, you get a little, you got a little bit of a whiplash there on that return there, on that U-turn there, Mayor. He also says he supports the reinstatement of the historic state historic tax credits, which would help certain projects and would support more state and federal incentives beyond that. Walls has included his historic credits in his budget, so, you know, we'll have to see if those go through. I think it's a good idea. And frankly, can I say this? I would go out on a limb and say, you want to see the downtowns explode again? All of a sudden start turning the high-rise towers into apartments. Because I guarantee you a lot of people would think about doing that, would think about going in onto those and trying to get in on that action. I really do. And so it's... Yeah, I think it's just the nature of change. And the reality is Minneapolis is still an amazing city. It still is cool. All you paranoid freaks there's like, it's a war zone. We don't need you. You can stay away. Bye-bye. Good luck. All you, why are you here, by the way? Because it's more expensive to be here around the city you hate than it would be like in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Off you go. Bye-bye. We won't miss you. Now, that being said, I like the idea, frankly. I really do. We'll have to see if it actually comes to fruition, though. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Hey, Jeff Stein will join us. We'll talk some national political news when we do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.
Jeff. Jeff
Stein's our national and presidential expert, noted author. Find his books over at Next Chapter Books, totallyiowa.com, the Iowa Business Report, and the Iowa Politics Report. Come to us via KXEL in Cedar Falls, Waterloo, where he is joining us today. If you're watching, there he is on the video stream. Hi, Jeff.
So when the kids are all gone,
yes,
will you and your spouse move to a downtown condo or apartment or something like that? I heard just a bit of the last segment, and I have heard from a lot of people, and it's not to the same scale as what you were just talking about, but they've tried to do similar things in downtown Des Moines, a city you're familiar with, and I hear more and more people who say, we're empty nesters, we don't need all this space, we'd like to get to some resurgent activity, and they buy lofts or apartments downtown.
And don't miss one of the biggest advantages of that. No more driveway to shovel, no more yard to mow. You know,
oh, absolutely.
And it does give you, I know a lot of people, who are maybe not retired, but in their 50s who have indeed sold their houses because the price is right. They're moving, they're getting top dollar for their place in the suburbs and they're moving into the downtown.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. They're not retired. They're just empty nesters. And so I didn't know if that would be something. Or is your wife going to say, why don't you get one of those places, Matt? And the sooner the better. I'll just stay where I am.
I got a tent in the backyard.
It's really small and you have to share it with the dog, but you do have it.
The feet are out at night. All right. I'm going to start off with Idaho. Because I think what we're doing is we're starting to get to where, and I have said this before, that with the overturning of the Roe v. Wade decision last year, Republicans who have had these anti-abortion voters who have been incredibly loyal are terrified of them not showing up. And as a matter of fact, I think that played a bit of a role in what happened last year. So they're desperately trying to find ways to engage the culture warriors again in different ways. Idaho has House Bill 242, which passed through the House and Senate, and the state House, likely to move through the Senate, seeks to limit minors' ability to travel for abortion care without parental consent. The legislation would create a whole new crime dubbed abortion trafficking, which is defined in the bill as an adult who, with the intent, now, and by the way, they should add the adult here. They didn't have that in the initial description here. Adult who, with the intent to conceal abortion from the parents or guardian of a pregnant, unemancipated minor, either procures an abortion or obtains an abortion-inducing drug for said minor. So, now, part of this is, okay, you're describing if an adult that doesn't have control over a child takes a child into a different state, that's a federal crime called kidnapping, which they will be charged for. So that's irrelevant.
Right.
But it kind of, we're getting into this thing where they're desperately trying to figure some way out of behind the interstate commerce law, which basically, say Washington allows 16-year-olds to go get an abortion without parental consent. That a 16-year-old in Idaho who can't get an abortion goes over there, they want to find some way to prosecute them. But I'm crazy. That'd be like trying to prosecute someone who goes to Colorado and smokes a bunch of dope and then comes back to Minnesota where it's not legal and saying, well, you smoked dope over there, so we're going to charge you with a crime here. You can't really do that, can you?
No, and the one distinction that you just made, let's say that you've got the 19-year-old goes to Colorado, smokes dope there. Well, that's fine. They can do it. It's legal there. Buying it there where it is legal and bringing it back to Minnesota where it is not legal, okay, that's a crime. But that's not at all what you're talking about. No. And to put a rule like this in place violates the Freedom of Association Clause of the Constitution. It violates the Commerce Clause.
Yeah.
And the analogy I would draw would be those states in the Deep South in the 60s that wanted to keep blacks from staying at hotels. And those laws were thrown out because people have the right to move and travel. And again, was it a little bit of a stretch of the, quote, Commerce Clause? Well, this was a financial transaction, a hotel room.
Yeah.
I mean, so when you're talking about, and it was a very astute point, if an adult takes a child across state lines, arguably that's the federal offense of kidnapping. So you've got that part covered. But what if that 16-year-old who is pregnant drives herself across the state line and goes and gets the abortion? The state of Idaho is going to stand there at the county line, in essence, and ask for a medical test or papers, please, about where you were. It's a desperate attempt to control behavior.
Yes.
And you want to outlaw it in your state, you can. But to tell your citizens they cannot travel, that's a big problem. Look, all they're doing with this law is trying to deter people from taking children across state lines, which, as you already noted, is illegal, mm-hmm. can be illegal depending on the situation. They're just trying to deter people from engaging in the activity because there's no way that it is going to be found. I will say there's no way it's going to be found to be constitutional because you're limiting freedom of movement in the country.
Exactly. Well, and you bring up, okay, and I think the most astute point would be, say a state does allow 16-year-olds to get an abortion without parental consent, and there's a state that doesn't have it, and they go mm-hmm. over and they're considered a minor still in the state they come back. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if someone came out and said, yes, I did. And then it puts a state like Idaho in a box where they say, do we really waste the state taxpayer dollars prosecuting a crime that did not happen in our state? So henceforth, wasn't a crime here. Because now I'm not saying they won't. I mean, Missouri is another state that's actually suggested putting, you know, that pregnant women cannot leave. I mean, I don't know if you remember that right after the election. Yeah. There were Republicans there that were saying, we're going to make it a rule to where a pregnant woman cannot leave the state, which is insane. But this is where they're at. And I think they're looking for a chance to basically just so they can show off and say, see, we're still fighting this. We're going to stop these other states from doing it. Even though I agree with you, there's no way on the planet, even with that Supreme Court, that they're going to say, oh, yeah, you didn't violate the Interstate Commerce Clause. Of course they did. And so you're not going to be able to, you know, it'd be like, are you going to start arresting people for using the lottery in states, you know, and then coming back to a state that doesn't have the lottery? I mean, it really does kind of become an insanely stupid argument for Idaho to try to even put this forward.
The devil is always in the details. And it's one thing to say, if we do not have a quote-unquote national rule, law, whatever, on the topic, and I'm a big states' rights person, just generally, okay? But if you're going to say we don't have a national standard on this, you're going to have to put up with, as a state, the fact that you cannot cover every contingency. Yes. Here's a contingency they didn't think of, right? So now it's like, oh, well, we better put a stop to this. It's fine to talk about it. It's, you know, again, in so many of these areas where the Constitution is involved, Matt, where we say, well, we need to pass a law. Okay, let's pass one. But first, you're going to have to write it. And then it's going to have to comport with the Constitution. And then, and then, and then, and then. It's not as easy as it looks. But the other thing is, and this is something that folks on the right grudgingly will admit, when they were raising money to get Roe overturned, they were bringing in tons of cash.
Yep.
Many politicians, many groups. All right, Roe's overturned. Now what? It's not the same to say, you need to still give us buckets of money because we just got used to all your money. You know, I mean, it doesn't have the same thing to say so that we can buy off lawmakers to pass laws that won't stand constitutional scrutiny. They've lost the argument. They've lost the advantage. And I don't mean to make light of it because this is the issue, social issue of our time. But it's sort of like the dog that chases cars and then one day he catches it. Well, now what do? You don't have opposable thumbs. You can't drive unless it's a Subaru commercial. All right. They got what they wanted. Now, what are you going to do with it?
Well,
and that's the tricky part.
And they're trying to mold this now to the transgender issue. And, you know, once again, well, if someone brings a child against their parents' will into a state, okay, the kidnapping clause, once again, you're mm-hmm. talking about kidnapping. So that's there's already laws on the books on this.
Right.
But then they want you to ignore that and kind of, well, a 6-year-old being dragged into a doctor's office and they're telling them to mutilate their genitals. Well, that just does not happen, you know, as you're kind of trying to portray it. And like I said, they're trying desperately to find a way to keep the culture warriors on their side. And the reality is that they keep running up against these rules that, sure, your state can ban it. Knock yourself out. That's what the Supreme Court said you can do. I don't agree with it, but that's what you can do. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you don't have the ability to control other states. And so you can't look at another state and say, you have to do it the way we want to. And they're trying to figure out some way that they can do that. But as you brought up, the Commerce Clause, doesn't really give him too much wiggle room on that issue.
Well, look what happened, and I won't have the exact facts right, but it'll be close enough. The Iowa legislature passed one of these bills that became law with regard to transgender students in schools. And I think at the same time, Minnesota passed a very different law. And the governor of Minnesota, I think, made a public statement of, you folks in Iowa, come on up here. Oh, that's how it's done. You don't like the laws where you're at, move.
Yes.
You know, I mean, in one respect, right?
And by the way, they are, too. I'm noticing some of those numbers, too.
You know, and I mean, I don't care if we're talking about taxation. I don't care if we're talking about
marijuana use.
Any of these issues. Yeah. You don't like the laws, try to affect change through elections. If that doesn't work, you know, the road goes both ways.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that, and that's what, you know, in some of these things that are going on in my state, the Democrats are very clearly in the minority based on election results. And nobody's complaining about the propriety of election results. And so they get up, they give the good fight. And my response is, I guess you better win more elections. And I don't mean to be flip, but that's just how the thing works. Now, we have this thing called the Full Faith and Credit Clause of the Constitution. And you and I have talked about it before. And it's in reverse with the example you gave with Idaho. Washington says it's legal. So an act done legally in Washington has to be accepted by other states. And the best example is back when the legality of same-gender marriage was not clear. There were just a very couple of states that allowed it. And I can go back, it's about 20 years. And there was a judge in the state of Iowa who granted a divorce between two married women. But same-gender marriage was not legal in Iowa. And you think, well, how does that work? They got married with a valid license in a state that allowed two women to marry. They then moved to Iowa. The laws of that other state had to be acknowledged and respected by the state of Iowa, to where their marriage broke up. And so the way you dissolve a legal marriage is through a dissolution of marriage. So we had gay divorce in Iowa before we had gay marriage because of the Full Faith and Credit Clause. So to your excellent argument about Idaho, let's turn it on its head. This was legal in Washington. You're now going to prosecute someone in Idaho for doing something legal in Washington, same as with the marijuana, Colorado back to Minnesota.
Exactly. I know they want to find a way to make this happen, all you're going to do, and I even think a lot of Republicans would look at this and say, why are you wasting our taxpayer dollars on this? We're not going to win this. And I think that it's going to be interesting. It's interesting to see Idaho be the first one to kind of try to start formulating some way, because you know Idaho wants to be able to say, we're going to prosecute anyone that goes out of state for an abortion. But they can't really do so, and they even know it. So it will be interesting to see where this goes. Let's turn our attention actually to Waco and the Trump rally there. Were you surprised at the, you know, this is a county, the county where Waco's at was, what, 237,000. You're 90 minutes away from Dallas. This is supposed to be red Republican territory. And he did not have, I mean, they said 10,000 people. You're looking at that picture. There wasn't a lot of people there. Your thoughts, I mean, not so much about the content of it, but the turnout, I mean, shouldn't there be a little bit of concern more for the Trump campaign about is everyone that if you are the front runner, where is everyone?
Well, by just sheer luck, I was filling in hosting a national program on Monday.
Oh.
And so I was able to take callers who actually attended the event.
Okay.
And I had seen your tweet saying, Jesus, look at all the room. They could have closed off this section and they still, you know, you remember you had a nice aerial photo, right?
Yep.
And they seemed to think it was about 10,000. Okay. Well, whatever. The response I would give you is twofold. One, and I'm not going to go through the old, well, it was 90 degrees in Texas and the people were, you know, Final Four was on. I don't care about that. I mean, yes, maybe those were factors, but if you're really a devotee, you're standing in line for hours. You're bringing hydration. You don't care. If you've gone to see the phenomenon once, do you go a second and third and fourth time? There are some who do.
Well, they do, and I think now. But I think your point, you're getting on the right point. Do you go the 10th time?
Well, exactly.
Exactly.
Well, and again, I don't go out in public. It's not advised. But, I don't know. When you go to a movie, do you go see the same movie in the theater however many times? I mean, TV's different because, well, it's right there and I don't have to get up. I can see going to see The Phenomenon once. All right, you want to go twice, go twice. At some point, it's like, I think I already know what this is going to be. Now, does that automatically mean the support is soft? Not necessarily. It just may mean, I've seen this movie. I know how it ends. But you better darn well be watching, because if this is repeated elsewhere, and to your broad point, why was the first big outdoor rally of the season in Waco, Texas? Because they thought it would look good.
Yeah.
Because they thought it would be a good crowd. I don't think, the initial phenomenon was the initial phenomenon. And I don't know that you can repeat it. But here's something briefly that I found interesting. And again, I'm hosting this other program. The host is decidedly right of center, and callers are calling in, and they have the same political temperament. A number of them who were sour on Trump because of statements, et cetera, it's not that they're jumping ship. It's not that they would vote for a Democrat, but they would really prefer to have another choice this time out. And I thought that was really striking. I saw an analyst, and I stole it because I can't remember who said it originally, but this was my commentary today here. The Trump, and again, this is somebody else who came up with this and I just stole it. The Trump of 2016 talked about Americans. The Trump of 2024 talks about Trump.
Mm-hmm.
That is a decided difference. And you can bring a lot of independents along if you're talking about about rank and file Americans like them. If you're talking about perceived slights and insults and stolen elections and all of this, that's much more about you as opposed to the voter. And that's an opening for someone in either party.
If Trump endorsed DeSantis, I think that things would look a lot more rosier for the Republicans. I just don't think that there's ever a chance he ever will. And I just don't think he will. Like, can I tell you what? Let's take a break. We'll come on back. Let's talk the reaction to Nashville and the latest shooting at a school. Jeff Stein joining us, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Jeff Stein joining us for his usual weekly visit. Jeff.
What is on your shirt?
Oh, this is Dury. This is the band Dury out of Burnsville. And by the way, great story. The guy, Adam Dury, was in a band. Pandemic hit. So he and his sister started making music in his home just to keep up with it. They end up becoming TikTok stars. They're now touring and selling out shows across the country. They're fantastic. They're very good. I really highly recommend Dury. And I'm a fan.
Well, the audience just needs to know, because you're doing the stream on the Facebook, or I don't know, whatever you do it on.
And interwebs, yes.
Maybe you're projecting it onto a billboard on I-94. I have no idea what you're doing. But on the commercial break, Matt gets up. This is now his new thing. And walks to the camera. So it's like Paul McNeil. And he's, pointing to his body and showing T-shirts and things. And I have no idea what it means. So I had to ask. And if you want in on the fun, I guess you should follow this stream on the Facebook.
Just watch. It's always good times. It's always a disturbing image with the Matt McNeil Show.
Scared to death. I'm fully scared to death.
I have been somewhat shocked at the Republican response. Not all Republicans, but definitely a lot of them who are, after the latest school shooting in Nashville, 6 dead, 7 with the shooter. And the mentality is, nope, we're not going to fix it. They could ban assault weapons tomorrow. That's already been legally determined to be okay. The Supreme Court said you can do this. It's your kids, and for lack of a better way to say it, it's them basically saying your kids, sacrificing your kids is the price we have to pay for our interpretation of how the Second Amendment should go. And I don't think not only am I stunned by this, I don't think it's the political winner these guys think it is.
You and I have talked over and over about what a complicated issue this is. You can take no one action, whether it is the banning of guns, whether it is mental health treatment and care. You need all of these things. The problem is bigger than one component. There is a large cadre of people in the Republican Party who feel if they give an inch on weapons, guns, then somebody else is going to take a mile. They don't want to seem like they are weak on the issue. And until people sit down and stop worrying about whether it will lose them five votes to take a nuanced view that would save lives, well, then we're not going to get anywhere. I mean, we're not going to get anywhere until there's a level of people who say, let's come up with a broad solution. And no one piece will fix it, but let's try to attack it from a variety of standpoints. But again, the number one goal of a politician is to get elected. The number two goal is to get reelected. Mm-hmm. And that's the cowardice we have in American politics. We do not have statesmen and stateswomen. We have people who are reading public opinion polls and not necessarily doing the right thing.
Outstanding statement. The 120th gun mass shooting in this country since the beginning of the year, which we're at yesterday was day 86. 89th mm-hmm. incident with a gun in a school so far this year. 89th, once again, 86th day. We're having them on such a level. I'm of the mindset that eventually what's going to happen here is just so many people are going to be affected by gun violence. I mean, everyone in that school is affected by it now. Every kid is going to be traumatized forever. I think eventually it's going to get to a point where, much like, you know, prohibition, you're going to get people who are saying, you elect me, I'm going to rewrite the Second Amendment. We'll fix the Constitution and we'll fix that. I know that the gun people do not want that to happen, but I just don't know where else you think you're going to go unless you can, as you say, come up with some more moderate, you know, responses outside of we're not going to do anything.
The problem I have, and I'm cynical, I'm sorry, I'm old, that's the way it is, but my fear is that it's happening so frequently we're becoming desensitized to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're accepting it as a part of polite society. You know, that's going to happen. Boy, really? Then we've given up. And I don't think we want to do that in any aspect much, at the least of it, a school.
Especially when we're talking about the lives of young children, nine-year-olds.
Yeah,
nine-year-olds,
yeah.
For goodness sake. Yeah. Jeff Stein, once again, his books over at Next Chapter Books, totallyiowa.com. The Iowa Politics Report, I'll post a little bit later on. We will talk to you in 2 weeks, Jeff. Thank you very much. Hour two is up next. Hour number two of the show here on your Wednesday. Matt and Brett here. Jack Rice going to join us here a little bit to talk about the Lazaro case here. And they have resumed, and it's, yeah. I'll get to a little bit of that before we get to Jack here at the bottom of the hour. Brett, I have a question for you. You are a sports mind. You are a better sports mind than I am. I call half these players by the – I mispronounced their names for 12 years. So – someone has made the suggestion on ESPN that the Vikings should waive Kirk Cousins and bring in Lamar Jackson, and that they say if you did that, you would win the Super Bowl. The Vikings would immediately become one of the favorites to win the Super Bowl. Now, last I saw, Jackson had some serious injuries, which I don't know if they're necessarily a good sign. But your thoughts on that? You know sports better than I do.
I think that's got to be a little more complicated than what they're saying, because it's not like you release Kirk Cousins and all of his salary comes off the books.
Yeah,
part of that salary is going to be on that cap.
So yeah,
depend on the figures, but I'd probably say a hard no on that, just because you would have no money to spend on any other players.
I think Kirk Cousins, I think he definitely has gotten more grief than he deserves as far as his football playing ability. He is actually a decent quarterback. Some of those games last year, you don't win if not for Kirk Cousins putting balls on dimes, and he did a very good job last year. That being said, I agree with you there. And then I also think just Jackson's injuries, weren't they knee?
Yeah. I think they were, yeah.
Yeah, isn't that the kiss of death? I mean, Lamar Jackson is an amazing talent when he can run and throw. But when he can just throw, He's a very mediocre quarterback. He got beat quite a few times last year because of his mobility issues. I think that that's too much of a risk.
It is the Vikings tradition, though, to always sign quarterbacks who are way past their prime and then expect good things to happen.
I'm going to say this. I say this every year. They don't listen to me. Draft an offensive lineman. Draft defensive lineman. That's your first two rounds every year, because you can take a mediocre quarterback and turn him into a great quarterback if they got 12 seconds, 15 seconds to throw every time. And that's just, I mean, you look at the best teams. What do they draft? They draft linemen every time. They get the best of the position, they go in there. My guess is they'll, you know what we are going to do? We're going to go get a kicker. No, you're going to get a wide receiver or a quarterback.
All right. Corners. Yeah, that's what they always got under the previous regime that ran the team.
All right, enough about that. So I got a little gem for you that got sent to my my attention here. This is from the state of Minnesota in Supreme Court. This was filed March 21st, A21-1411. In re petition for disciplinary action against Elizabeth Bloomquist, a Minnesota attorney. Registration number, blah, 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 blah. The director of the Office of Lawyers, professionally responsibility, has filed a petition for disciplinary action alleging that respondent Elizabeth W. Bloomquist has committed professional misconduct warranting public discipline, namely failing to diligently pursue criminal cases that were within her jurisdiction as a city attorney, such that many were barred by statute of limitations and failing to comply with minimum Minnesota state statutes as well. Respondent and the director have entered into a stipulation for discipline. In it, the respondent waives her procedural rights under Rule 14. The admitted allegations of petition establish that between 1989 and 2019, respondent worked as the city attorney for the city of Fairmont. Have you ever been to Fairmont, Minnesota?
I have not, no.
It's right dead center. It's right, I'm going to guess it's 5 miles from the Iowa border, dead square center, southern border, Minnesota, Fairmont.
Yeah, just it's right off like I-90, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's west of Blue Earth down there. Yeah. I think you're right. It's right off 90. So this is the city we're talking about, Fairmont. Beginning in 2012, respondent's previously full-time legal assistant started taking on other duties, affecting respondent's ability to efficiently process criminal cases within the city's jurisdiction. As the city decided in 2019 to terminate respondent's employment for reasons unrelated to the misconduct described in the petition, it became evident that she had not resolved by making a charging decision a large number of police reports, over 135. She had 135 police reports, and she did not file charges on those reports. Some 51 of those cases were at the point time barred, including 26 that could otherwise have been charged out or further investigated. In addition, 27 of the time barred cases were domestic assault cases. With respect to which prosecutor has a duty under Minnesota statute to notify the victim and that the prosecutor has decided to decline prosecution and to dismiss the criminal charges against the defendant. So 27 times she had domestic assault cases, and the statute says if you do not file charges, you have to call the victim and explain this, and apparently she never did this. Because of her failure to take action in these matters, respondent failed to comply with the requirements of the statute. Therefore, respondent misconduct involved a lack of diligence in violation of other rules. They go through their nature of the problems here. Go through public reprimand, stuff like that. Typically, a public reprimand is appropriate for significant lack of diligence relating to a small number of client matters. In this case, but in this matter, respondent neglect appears to have encompassed as many 135 potential criminal matters extending over a period of 7 years, and more than 50 of which became time barred. As the director acknowledged in an informal memorandum she provided with the party's stipulation, this case is one of the first impression. We have not addressed a situation where the government attorney neglected a large number of charging decisions in this manner. The director further explained her position that the public reprimand is appropriate in the matter of a number of reasons. So we're talking the city of Fairmont. They got a city attorney. And if any city, any county, they have a county attorney, they have a city attorney. This is basically what you have. You know, it's your legal person that's supposed to know the laws ins and outs of the local jurisdiction so that, you know, say someone wants to build a building and, you know, they want to do something, that person can do this. I, for a long time, was part of my city's planning and zoning committee. And we had our lawyer consistently came in and talked about size of signage, that certain signs could not be certain sizes. And they had, because this was the city law. And so people would come in and they'd want to put up a much bigger sign. And they say, no, you're violating the law. You have to put in a sign that's this size. That's kind of the rule. That sort of thing. Now, that's not what we're talking about here. I mean, I wish we were just talking about signage issues. 135 times. The police handed to the city prosecutor a crime that should have been either further investigated or prosecuted. It does sound like, indeed, specific prosecution should have been filed. And 135 times, this person didn't do anything at all. And over 50 of those cases, they've expired. She can't, even if someone came in behind them, the state attorney general or something, they couldn't file charges in any of these cases because she didn't do her damn job. This is unbelievable. In the memorandum, the director and respondent each take the position that the respondent's position is the city attorney, when she committed the misconduct, should not be considered an aggregating factor. In particular, the director argues that previous cases in which they viewed attorney's position on prosecutor as be aggravating factor typically involve intentional conduct resulting in the abuse of power. That's not the case here. Among the misconduct, other misconduct dismissed or delayed depositions, stuff like that. In response to the inquiry about the factors to consider when deciding on the appropriate discipline, the parties discussed and provided additional context. You can tell it's a bit of a dry read. All right, so it's a legal brief from this. It's real wordy. I got through five pages. That's about as much as I'm gonna get through on this. Holy God! I've never heard of this. I've never heard of anything like this. A city attorney not filing the charges as they're supposed to. If I'm in Fairmont, in the town of Fairmont, and a crime happened to me, and now it's bad. I'm sorry, you better get ready for a class action lawsuit against you for failure to basically hold people accountable. And God forbid we find out one of those, 27 domestic assault cases that cannot be prosecuted anymore because they've gone beyond the time. God forbid you had a case there where someone has actually done more damage to the other person or, God forbid, killed them as this prosecutor basically didn't do their job. Like I said, I don't know the intricacies of the ins and outs of all this stuff. I can just tell you this. I've never heard of a city attorney just not doing their job. And once again, the police are giving her the files. Here's the case. You need to charge the person. They just didn't do it. 952-946-6205. I am a little interested. Why did she get fired if it wasn't for this reason? Let me see if I can find the... They terminated respondents' employment in 2019 for reasons unrelated to the misconduct described in the petition. So something else happened. I can take some speculation. I mean, there's a lot of things you could, you know, you get into a fight in the office, alcoholism, stuff like that, you know, but apparently she was let go prior to them knowing she had not prosecuted over 135 of the crimes that she was supposed to prosecute. Or at least I should be careful. Prosecute or further investigate. You know, some of them might not have been prosecuted because they might have, you know, they might have done a further investigation and realized there was no crime there. But I guess we don't know now. 952-946-6205. Lou Ragus over, I believe, at Care 11 is following the Lazaro trial. He's been doing some updated today. I'm going to read some of his tweets today in regards to what's been going on today before we talk to Jack Rice. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. Lou Ragus over at Care 11 has been following the Lazaro trial. I'm just going to read off his Twitter thread here because this will give you a pretty decent update about what's been going on. And once again, just listen to this first part. The prosecutor, Melinda Williams, says the FBI received a call from Charles Bittman, a former business partner of Lazaro's, gave information to the prosecution team. Long story short, the man has text, photos, and videos relevant to the case sent to him by Lazaro. He now has shared those. He sent the FBI team to Texas to get from his phone. Now the prosecution wants to use some of that evidence in cross-examination. The evidence includes a photo that's been mentioned quite often in the trial that Lazaro took with the three girls in his bed, as well as videos Lazaro took where his voice can be heard. Now there's jury in the courtroom. They bring the jury in because, once again, they got started later today. Slow start to the testimony. Lazaro is testifying about the people introduced to him by Gisela Castro. Medina, she says 30 in all. He says 30 in all. Men and women, didn't have sex with most of them, he says. Well, once again, who is his defense team here? Because this is the defense team interviewing him at this point. Lazaro emails and a handful of others, he says, Gisela introduced him to and brought something for or gave something but did not have sex with. All right. Lazaro compares his contacts with females to multi-level marketing tiers where one person introduced him to another who introduced him to another. It was unusual. Those people were all contacting me, wanting me to hang out, or at least wanted something from me. Usually when you meet someone on a dating site, you meet 30 or their friends. It was kind of weird. Like, these are the people getting my contact information. Lazaro's testimony closes explaining his message becoming concerning broken girls, the broken girls thing. I literally was talking to Gisela once. I said something like, I always end up dating broken girls or girls I end up trying to fix, girls with issues. I was faulting myself for it because I try to come in as a savior, I guess you could say, he laughs. There was never any suggestion to Gisela to go out and find me broken girls, which has been the testimony so far. The context of the message was pretty clear that the government keeps showing the little snippets. Now prosecutor Melinda Williams begins cross-examination, saying she plans to get very specific. You have had sex with 15 and 16-year-olds, she says. No, Lazaro answers. I had sex with a 15-year-old who then lied and said she was 17. Wow. This guy. That doesn't mean she wasn't 15. You wanted minors under the age of 18 to have sex with, is that right? Lazaro, not specifically, no. You wanted small girls, physically small? I prefer women who are in shape. Yes, that's true. You prefer women that are tiny? I wouldn't say tiny. You are a wealthy man? I used to be. You used your money to purchase what you wanted. You used your money to purchase 16-year-old girls to have sex with. Never, ever, he says. You like broken girls, girls with problems? No. Well, Mr. Lazaro, they certainly were broken. No. Lazaro, I don't think the rest I met through Gisela were broken. There were girls 16 and 19 who partied a lot. You paid Gisela Castro Medina to recruit these girls? No. To bring them to you? No. You put them on Ubers, brought them to you? Yes, I'd order Ubers all the time. So that's a yes to transport. Transport, sure. God, they're picking him apart. They're picking him apart. Williams accuses Lazaro pretending to care about the girls. Lazaro denies and says he cares about everyone. Oh, come on. Do you think Anton Lazaro cares about me? Brett, do you think he cares about you? Because he says he cares about everyone. Did you ever take an Uber over to the Hotel Ivy? I never got an Uber over to the Hotel Ivy. I never got a Happy Meal in a Disney movie. Apparently he doesn't care about me. That's the way I'm taking it. Says he cares about everyone, when in fact you were just grooming them. What does that mean? enticing them with alcohol and your money. I won't use that characterization. Well, it's irrelevant how you'd use the characterization, really, at this point. It's what the legal team is. Lazaro says he doesn't even remember offering someone money to take off their top. You never did that? Maybe at a strip club. Okay, so you can't say I didn't do it and then turn around and say, oh, yeah, maybe at a strip club. Okay. Williams rattles off what he alleged victims have testified to, that Lazaro offered money to take off this, money to take off that. Lazaro reluctant to say he saw the five minors naked, so Williams boils it down. Did you ever have sex with each of the minor victims in this case? The five people identified, yes. So you saw them naked? Yes. Lazaro continues to deny that he paid any of the alleged victims for sex. He denies paying a 16-year-old victim, victim A, $50 to send him a selfie when they first met online. He says it was for a cheeseburger. You sent $50 to him for a cheeseburger? That's your argument. You sent him her $50 for a cheeseburger. Williams is drilling down on what she called the grooming of the teens. He would talk with them about their problems upon first meeting. You put on a mask of sympathy for these young girls. I am very real with people. I'm not going to put a mask on. They are taking a 15-minute afternoon break. They take this break, and this is Lulu Ragus. Judge Schultz is very PO'd at Lazaro. You are purposely trying to introduce stuff to jury that you know is off limits, such as mentioning that he is in jail. Mr. Lazaro, you want just to answer the question that is asked. Let your lawyers do the lawyering. If you continue to do this, I'm going to stop you and correct you in front of the jury. Lazaro, the jail thing. I don't know about that. I'm not trying to violate a court order. You are not a lawyer, judge says. You are a defendant. Now Lazaro is standing in the podium asking the judge if he can mention the state law regarding age consent, which is 16, because he says the government keeps insinuating that he broke the law by having sex with the teens. Judge tells him he can't bring that in the info about the state age of consent, and the prosecutors are going to refer to under 18 rather than under 16 when talking about the alleged crimes here. Regarding prosecutor Williams' comment, so that's a yes to transport. Here is my note from the opening statements where they told the jury they need only to prove that the phrases here for the element of sex trafficking of minors, the elements of sex trafficking of minors, the defendant knowingly recruited, enticed, harbored, transported, provided, obtained, maintained, patronized, and solicited minors. So basically they've got him to admit that he transported them. That the prosecution team didn't. Now they're arguing about this new evidence from the business partner that they're going to use it when impeaching Lazaro on the stand. One involves a text with a reference to Jeffrey Epstein. Wow. Wow. Really? Of course, who was accused of sex trafficking of minors. When Lazaro was arguing to Judge Schultz, he was using legal terms like mens rea, which basically means intent or what he was thinking. The guy has clearly spent some time doing research. Coming back from the break, Prosecutor Melinda Williams is asking him about serving his 16-year-old victim, victim A, alcohol, at the same time not drinking. You kept your wits about you then, but them, not so much. Lazaro denies paying Gisella and victim A to take off their shirts, admits having sex, denies paying for the sex, saying he gave victim A money for the phone and gave Gisella money for schooling. I did not pay them for sex. Williams continues to show the photo, this time asking if he tried to entice the teens. This was not to entice him. You're not showing in context. And this is basically a picture of, I'm going to guess it's Lazaro. I'm going to guess it is, with stacks of cash as he's wearing some Minnesota Vikings boxer briefs, which I got to mean the Vikings are really happy about that. Yeah. In a bathroom, by the way. And by the way, can I say clean up your mirror? Prosecutors asked Lazaro about putting on the Lion King and Finding Nemo. Sweet Lord, for victim A and Gisella, the two times they came over together. I think Gisella liked Disney stuff, he said. Lazaro again repeatedly denied asking Gisella Castro Medina to be his recruiter. He denies having paid a recruiter in California, although a friend hooked him up with four or five girls over the course of time there. Did you pay this friend? No. But you paid Castro Medina. I gave her gifts. You gave her cash. Yeah, among other things. Well, that's called paying her, if you gave her cash. Williams accuses Lazaro of preferring girls who would be easiest to groom. I didn't even know what that means, Lazaro answered. Now Williams is about to show some of the new evidence from Lazaro's former friend, Charles Bittman. A what's up text message. Lazaro, why is... This is why strip clubs, alcohol are bad. This girl is coming over, but it's almost 3 a.m. See why I use Gisela recruiters/recruiters/SA. Save hours and hours. Again, Williams set up this text message revelation by asking Lazaro several times about using Gisela's recruiter, which he continued to deny, and then basically puts her in the same group as a recruiter. Williams questioning Lazaro about his bio and his seeking arrangement website, asking meeting girls under 18 to 25. Lazaro keeps trying to dodge, claiming he doesn't know what it says. I enjoy meeting girls under 18. Williams is now showing Snapchat videos of Lazaro sent to his former friend, Charles Bittman, that show drunk teen girls wrestling in his apartment and spilling drinks, tipping stuff over. Williams shows another video of a teen girl shuffling through the stack of $100 bills. Lazaro paid her. Prosecution believes it's $900 he paid two separate teens for sex. The number of surprise evidence prosecutors received overnight really hurts Lazaro because it testified yesterday that the photo didn't happen the way the girl said it did. The trophy photo, as Williams refers to it, shows three teens face down on the bed. Yesterday, you said you took a selfie. The photo is redacted because it's explicit. I ain't going to keep this up very long, but it isn't. That ain't a selfie, Williams says. Yesterday, Lazaro said he hates lingerie. Just ask my girlfriend. Williams just showed another video Lazaro sent his former friend Charles Bittman that shows three teens in lingerie dancing in his condo. Hey, Charles, you like lingerie? Lazaro's voice can be heard saying, "Wow." It goes on here. I'll tell you what. Let's get Jack on the air because I think this guy, I mean, from this new evidence that's introduced today, I don't see how he's getting out of this. They have to wait for the ruling, though. Jack writes when we do return, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Sometimes I'd rather die. God, I'll get to Jack here. I want to run through the rest of this evidence that came in today through the FBI from Lazaro's former friend Bittman, who basically, you know, yeah, and this is devastating, I think, to Lazaro. Another text from Lazaro to Bittman, which prosecutors believe refer to victims in this case from August 2020. Quote, the fat one, XX, and the shy one want to come over right now. Going to hard pass LMAO. Williams, LMAO, because this was all fun and games for you? Another bit here. I want to prep you. I want you to prepare yourself, okay? I want you to prepare yourself because you're not going to believe this. More and more very incriminating text from Lazaro to Charles Bittman. August 10th, 2020, the one-year anniversary of the death of Jeffrey Epstein. Quote, poor Jeff. Quote, RIP my brother. Ugh. Regarding an Uber of teens driving at his place after Bittman asked him to take photos, breaking them in, Charles, this is an art of the tart. Lazaro says he's not proud, but that's how guys talk to each other. Williams, this is how guys talk to each other. I'm going to go back to Donald Trump and, say when he's like, locker room talk. No, this is not how decent people talk to each other. Lazaro testifies he was not pro-Epstein, that he was anti-government. Oh, my God. The text that Lazaro wrote on the anniversary of Epstein death that says RIP my brother is accompanied by a photo of Jeffrey Epstein, who is also charged with sex trafficking of minors. Lazaro kept saying he doesn't recognize Epstein because the photo is blurry. Oh my God. And once again, he testifies he was not pro Epstein, that he was anti the government as he was working for, working as an influencer within the Minnesota GOP. Yeah. This is disturbing. This is disturbing. Jack Rice is our legal expert. He is kind enough today to take some time to break down what he's seeing with the Lazaro case. Jack, as always, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be with you as always. How you doing?
I'm doing well, man. Thank you very much. I'm getting better, slow but surely. I'll get back, my friend.
I know. I'm watching you from afar, so just know that.
That's kind of scary.
not in a weird stalker sort of way. Oh. Just know. Well, maybe a little.
All right. It's okay, Jack. That's cool. We've made the determination. We have the Mount Rushmore of the Matt McNeil Show. It's Jeff Stein, Cliff Schechter, Dr. Joe, and you. You four are the best. You are the top. I'm putting you in the Roosevelt spot, okay?
Well, thanks. Although he's got some disturbing history of his own.
So. Yeah, they all have their baggage, don't they? Yes, they do.
Yes, they do.
Okay. I'm going to start with the question that Brett actually said, I think it was Thursday of last week. He's like, why in the world would Lazaro even try to win this case? The evidence against him is pretty astonishing. And I'm trying to take the side of the innocent until proven guilty. But as we've gone through this case, I don't see how in the world Lazaro thought he was going to be able to knock this down.
Yeah, this is a very, very difficult case. Understand, first of all, let's go real big picture. I mean, Anton Lazaro is really charged with federal sex trafficking. And it's a very, very difficult charge. When the feds take a case, you know they have something. Because remember, most criminal charges, you don't need to go to federal court. They can actually be done in state court. And so what will happen is that in federal court, the feds will take a case if they decide, usually, they really have a good case, a strong case, and they want to pull that trigger. So generally, when the feds are taking a case, it's because they feel really good that they got a really good case. And frankly, they've got a really good case because they have a co-defendant. And that co-defendant has already pled guilty, has already agreed to flip on Lazaro, and is going to do it. And so that's the really hard part.
Then we have the impact of victim A, B, C, D, and E. And the mother of one of them as well, which were... You know, first of all, horrible. What happened to these girls was horrible. But in regards to this court case, there weren't hurdles. They were 20-foot walls. I mean, he's just these were these stories. They all matched up. They backed up Medina, her story. It really became, the more we got into the prosecution's case, the less and less of an avenue out of it I saw for Lazaro.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. If we're going to talk about power. The power of a witness really is usually based upon something that will grab a jury and hold on to it. This is the nightmare of all nightmares for any parent where something like this happens. And what you get are five young women, all very consistent in who they are, consistent on what they look like, consistent on sort of how they're targeted. Their stories are very similar in nature. And the idea that somebody like this would go after them and then have each of them to go into this room in front of this jury of 12 and point directly at Lazaro and say, this is what he did to me. It's the collective power of witnesses like this that really viscerally drive a jury. And that's one of the things that the Lazaro defense team is struggling with right now.
I'm going to read this here, and this is from Lou Ragus over at Care 11 here. It sounds like this is the definition here, federal definition. Elements of sex trafficking of minors, the defendant knowingly recruited, enticed, harbored, transported, provided, obtained, maintained, patronized, or solicited minors. In that description, do you have to do just one of those things, or is it got to be all of those things or a combination of them?
It's one of those things. Now, really what this comes down to is something called the Mann Act. And the Mann Act in general was this. Is many years ago, all of these cases, first of all, the idea that you could pay a minor for sex, you can't do that. That's a felony in its own right. So that's true basically anywhere in the country. The difference is this. It's either a combination of crossing state lines or that paying for the sex and the coercive piece. And so it's the coercive piece that the defense team continues to argue about. But the problem is, is that a juvenile who is actually paid for sex, it's really in many ways built, the coercive nature of it is built in because a juvenile is generally not in a position to say, oh, sure, I'm going to have sex for you and I'm going to take money to do it. That's the problem that this team has, meaning the defense team, because of it. And then, by the way, here's an example. He had his girlfriend take the stand, and when his girlfriend took the stand, one of the things that the defense has problems with is this, is that there's something in criminal cases called jailhouse phone calls. And what happens is there's phones in all of these jails where these guys are held in custody. Lazaro's been in custody since 2021. Is that what's going on is he's picking up the phone even between court appearances or even at night after court. And he's talking to his girlfriend, who just took the stand, by the way. And in fact, the prosecutor laid this out where they made it clear that his girlfriend, who just took the stand, said this, and I quote, "You let me know what needs to get done, and I will literally kill people to get it done." That's the girlfriend. Now, think about what it does when you have a jury hear that a girlfriend will do just about anything that she's told. And by the way, this same girlfriend, the condo that's down at the Ivy downtown, that's been transferred into her name. The $40,000 Tesla, that's been given to her. The credit cards to pay for everything. It's showing a transfer of money mm-hmm. that sounds very oddly consistent with what he was doing with these other juveniles, although the girlfriend is not a juvenile.
And it does make, from what you just brought up, it does make me ask the question, does Lazaro not know that they can listen in on the jailhouse conversations? I mean, that's not unique, is it?
No, it's not unique. I have to tell you, Matt, I can't count the number of times I've seen this happen. And in fact, there's actually a sign up there in front of these phones that says that. The crazy thing is this, and this is true not just in the Lazaro case, but in other cases that I've had all over Minnesota, is that some people think if they talk in a confusing or fancy tone, that they somehow think that it's going to make the people seem like they won't figure out what they're talking about, you know? So you'll use code. But the problem is you can't lay out the code, and no matter what you say, it sounds stupid. So you end up sounding like an idiot, and the thing is a jury gets to hear your own words coming out of your own mouth. And when you see that, you realize just how much power that has when you combine it with 16-year-old victims talking about how their lives have been destroyed. And that's what they've been saying to this jury.
And Jack Rice joining us to talk about the Lazaro case. I want to bring up two things here that I want to get your take on why the judge knocked these two things down. The first was Lazaro. I know this from that case. There was a Duluth politician that was having, they had, consented sex with a 16-year-old. And I learned at that point that a 16-year-old, as long as it's not like a teacher to a student or a supervisor to a worker, they can engage in a sexual relationship legally in Minnesota. Lazaro was asking if he could basically mention the state law regarding the age of consent is 16, because he was upset at how the government says this. The judge came back and says he can't refer to the info about the state age of consent, but he says the prosecutors had to mention reference under 18 rather than under 16. Can you talk about that? Why wouldn't, I'm not necessarily looking to create a defense for Lazaro, but why would the judge be able to say, well, even though that's the state law, you can't mention it?
I know exactly what you're saying. Okay, so let's lay this out so people understand the distinctions here. Minnesota, it can be odd because some people don't know this. A full-grown adult can have sex with somebody who's 16, 17 years old. They're allowed to. It's legal. So long as they are, and this is the magic words, they are not in a position of authority. So in other words, the person doesn't work for them. The person's not a police officer. The person's not a priest. The person has never been overseeing them. You can even have somebody who is a babysitter. That's enough for position of authority. And so in this case, what Lazaro was trying to argue was, look, the person never worked for me. The person was never in a place where I had more authority over them. So they felt compelled or coerced. And so therefore, I want them to see this. The problem is this for Lazaro. The problem is that this is not about simply sex. This is about paying for sex. And that changes the dynamic, because he's trying to argue that the statute that should apply in this case is that he's allowed to have sex with minors. The problem is the statute that cuts the other direction is that felony when I was talking about earlier that says once you offer them, and in one case, according to the complaint by the prosecutor, by the AUSA, the assistant U.S. attorneys, was that he first gave somebody an iPhone and gave him $800 in cash, and that when you start transferring resources, when you start transferring money, all of a sudden, this turns this into not a sex with somebody between 16 and 18 and an adult. It's actually paying for sex, and that in itself in Minnesota is a crime regardless. And I think that's the reason that the judge in this case pulled back and said, you don't get to cherry pick. It's going to apply differently.
The other thing that I was kind of interested in is this. Okay, so yesterday you read that he was making excuses that those photos didn't exist, that they were actual selfies, that I didn't really take these photos. His friend, Charles Bittman, or former friend, I'm going to guess, a former business partner of Lazaro, contacted the FBI, said he had text messages and photos, which basically could help the FBI's case. The FBI went and got a warrant, got this information, and was able to bring this information into the case. Now, it's not exactly clear when this call was made, whether it was made yesterday or in the recent, you know, soon. But is that common to have, like, you know, okay, clearly this is evidence that contradicted Lazaro's testimony yesterday. And by the sounds of it, it's a nightmare for him today because of this evidence from Bittman. But is that common to have evidence that appears suddenly being introduced and being accepted by the judge to be presented within the court on a counter proposal?
Yeah, it's pretty weird. I mean, one of the things about any criminal case is that there's a requirement called disclosure. And this disclosure requirement is basically anything that the state has, anything that the government has, they're obligated to turn it over to the defense because they have the right based upon due process in order to prepare for a trial. What happens is if the government refuses to turn something over and then says, we're going to use this against you, then they're going to have a hard time generally speaking. And in fact, there are some things that the government must turn over, even if they don't want to, because there's something called Brady, which basically says anything that can help the defense that the government has. For instance, you have a police officer who's done a whole bunch of bad things, and then he turns around and arrests you, and you could potentially, as the defense, use that and say, you know all those bad things that officer did? We think he did those same bad things in our case, and that's why we are where we are. Mm-hmm. And so it is unusual when something sort of comes in and feels like it's last minute, because how is it that you're supposed to prepare for a case if you don't know that that's something you have to prepare for? And that's always one of those things that brings the potential for an appellate issue in the event that Lazaro was found guilty of these charges, because then he could then go up the chain to the Court of Appeals and say, hold on, they violated my due process. They were required to disclose some information. They failed to do so. Therefore, I get to start again.
And by the way, thanks to you being on the air so much, we know about the Brady stuff with Minneapolis police. Exactly. No, you're spot on as always, Jack. Could Bittman have contacted them yesterday and said, "Hey, I heard what he said today. I've got this stuff." Would that turnaround be something that would be potential? I mean, that could be one way that they could bring it in, is saying we just got this evidence yesterday, last night.
Yeah, I mean, I think that really is the difference. The idea that somehow we didn't have this, we couldn't have disclosed this, we didn't even know it existed either. As soon as we received it, we turned around and provided it. I had a jury trial not long ago in which something kind of similar happened, where I received a phone call at 9:30 at night in the middle of a trial from the prosecutor saying, I just got this thing, I didn't know it existed, and my response was, well, you should have known, I'm outraged, and et cetera. And so what ends up happening is then you go and you argue that out in front of the judge and say, hold on, if I had known about this, this may change the entire dynamic of my case. This is more prejudicial than probative. Those are legal, that's very specific legal language saying you shouldn't allow this in because it prejudices the defense to such a degree that they don't get a fair trial. But on the other hand, if the prosecutor doesn't know anything about this and it just drops from the sky, do you exclude it? And is that in the best interest of justice? Mm-hmm. You're always balancing the rights of the defendant on the one side and the rights of the those people who are fighting the case on behalf of the government, and you're trying to find that sweet spot. That's always the struggle the judge has.
I don't think this is going to be a long jury deliberation.
I think, as being the prognosticator that you are, Mr. Nostradamus, that I think you might be right. This is one of those cases because we really don't like people who are charged with this kind of thing, and juries have a hard time being terribly empathetic. Yeah. He has the right, and the state has the government has the obligation to prove their case, but jurors don't like this kind of a charge.
Jack Rice is the best defense attorney in Minneapolis-St. Paul. He is. He has won awards. He is fantastic. If you have a case, you want to sit down and talk with him, sit down with Jack. He'll give you an honest opinion. JackRiceLaw.com. That's JackRiceLaw.com. I'll link to that a little bit later on. Jack, outstanding as always. Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, my brother. I'll be watching you from afar.
Take care, my friend. Jack Rice, a friend in need and friend indeed. That's what, Jack. I appreciate everything he's helped me out with. We'll take a break, wrap up the show when we do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. By the way, both the Jeff Stein and the Jack Rice interviews will be up available, and they're probably already up at this point. I mean, Johnny on the spot over there on the other side of the glass. Brett, do you remember the Delaware, I think it was the Senate race in Delaware, where the Republican had to come on out with this gem, "I'm not a witch." you remember that?
That's one of the great campaign slogans of all time.
"I'm not a witch." When you are in your trial and you have to say, "I'm not pro Epstein," Jesus, I have never seen a case turn so badly against someone just from, and once again, I want to say, I'm reading what Lou Ragusa is writing here on Care 11. That's what I'm reading. That's what it is. He might be leaving out things. I don't know. I'm going with his, as he's sitting in the courtroom, the Bittman evidence is devastating because it pretty much annihilates his entire defense that this was misunderstanding, all this stuff. You have him. I mean, the text message where he says he refers to Medina as his kind of his arranger, coordinator. I mean, that's, yeah. He goes on to say, and this is, I think, is this what we've got? Is this the last one we've got, last updates we have before the end of the show here? Williams mentioned she wants to wrap this cross-examination up this afternoon. Not sure how much redirect Daniel Gertz will do. It will be going down to about 10 minutes to report live on Care 11. He says, he finally puts out, finally here, Williams reminding Lazaro of his characterizations. "It felt like they were trying to use me. They all wanted something from me. They're really shameless." Now using some of his own words against him, referring to himself as a wolf. All right. You and I said it. I mean, and this was before today. Well, and before yesterday, we were talking about that jail phone call with his girlfriend, how devastating that was that Jack brought up. Yeah. I don't know what he thinks he was going to accomplish here. But I think at the end of the day, if there was an offer on the table, I imagine he probably should have taken that, because I can't see this going, after what happened today, I can't see this going his way. I just can't. Once again, I might be missing something, but I just can't. Native Roots Radio up in the 6. Make sure you're staying for that. We're back tomorrow. Till then, see ya.